The first reading this morning is taken from a series of poems composed in Spanish and in English by Juan Pablo Gutierrez in 2011 to accompany watercolors of flowers painted by my very good friend Kevin Woodson, whom a number of you have met when he's visited me. Their combined book is called The Language of the Flowers, and this is the book, and this is one of Kevin's paintings of flowers that are in the book, painted here in Columbus, actually. Here is the English translation of Gutierrez's poem.
In passing, we wave to you from public spaces, from empty lots, from abandoned sites, from wealthy gardens, from churches, from pagan rituals, from atheist gardens, from street corners, on sidewalks, and makeshift altars. The gentle folds become clear syllables. The colors suddenly become action verbs, pistols like antennas, communicating sentences without punctuation marks. I turn the page again, finding a new awakening. Everywhere I turned, another page appeared as I continued to learn the language of the flowers.
And the second reading this morning is a perfect piece for today, during the flower ceremony. It's called simply Flowers, and it's by Linda Paston. It was written in 1995.
Someone I love is getting married, and I am composing poems about flowers, hyacinths, and lilacs, as if there were something intrinsically bridal about these outgrowths of the plant flaunting itself, attracting insects and birds to the exact and fragrant place of pollen. And someone I love is dying. Flowers will be wanted for her, too. Lilies, perhaps, though all that is required is a handful of good dirt on a plain pine box. And all the funeral bouquets will be sent to a hospital somewhere where the sick will wake one morning to a confusion of scents. I wonder, partly in innocence, why everything seems to mean something else, and I marvel at how we comfort ourselves and each other with the fragile symptoms of beauty, with petals of roses for love, with snowdrops for hope, whether we are setting out on a journey or simply waving goodbye from the dock as the ship pulls out and a wake of tossed flowers floats for a little while, delicate as foam on the water before it disappears.
Before I begin, I want to thank Sue Farnlocker for the beautiful flowers up here this morning, and also for making a special Easter candle for our chalice. The flame can be seen in the next county. I love it. In a stroke of good Easter sermon luck, I read that piece in the newspaper about the flower that Russian scientists resurrected, the one I mentioned to the children this morning, a 30,000-year-old Selene stenophylla seed that was lost in a squirrel's den, frozen in the permafrost, was found and then planted in modern soil. And it grew, blossomed, and produced new seeds that will grow into other lovely and quite delicate white flowers, stenophylla. A resurrected flower from a seed found in the permafrost is what the newspapers and the media called it. The word resurrected was not used by the scientists who planted it. It was used by the people who wrote the articles. The media was clearly trying to put a topical spin on the whole amazing event, and it is undoubtedly amazing. The particular newspaper that I read suggested that if we could restore this ancient flower, why not resurrect a woolly mammoth as well? Thus restoring an extinct species from perhaps some fleshy sample frozen in a snowdrift in Siberia. I suppose this is what lots of folks believe that the word resurrection means. The restoration of a body that was dead as the exact same person that was there before death. And indeed, some of the later gospel stories seem to imply that Jesus was walking around showing people the nail holes in his arms, thus proving he was exactly the same Jesus who was killed by Pontius Pilate's militia a few days earlier. But of course, the gospels were written many, many decades after Jesus died. The earliest proclaimer of the Easter message, the resurrection message, denied that clumsy interpretation plainly, clearly, and passionately. I'm speaking of Paul of Tarsus, who wrote about the resurrection business quite a lot. Now, please understand that only parts of six letters of the 12 attributed to Paul are authentically his, not a lot. The additions by later church folks telling women to be quiet in church have given Paul a pretty bad reputation, and understandably so. But you'll find none of that nonsense in the words that have come down to us, which are authentically his. Scholars are doing a pretty amazing job these days of restoring an ancient personality and clarifying his urgent message. Here is what he wrote, and these are his authentic words, to some folks in the Greek city of Corinthos, or Corinth, probably in the spring, in the year 54. This is the Eugene Peterson translation. Some skeptic is sure to ask me, how does this resurrection work? What does a resurrected body look like? Give me a diagram. Show me a picture. If you look at that question closely, you realize how absurd it is. There are no diagrams about this. But we do have a parallel experience when we garden. You plant a dead seed, and soon there is a flourishing plant. But there is absolutely no visual similarity between a seed and a flower. None. You could never guess what an apple blossom is going to look like by staring at that little teardrop-shaped seed inside the apple, right? What we plant in the soil and what comes out of it are dramatically different. The planting of a seed and rising of a live flower are a mere sketch at best, I admit. But perhaps this will help you to approach the mystery of what I mean by resurrection. And to some folks in Rome, he wrote, "Remember, you've been raised from the dead. A whole, healed, put together life right now, with more and more life on the way." Who's been raised from the dead? The people he was writing to in Rome, who had not died in any mortal sense. They were not in graves. They didn't come back out of the grave. He was talking to living people, and he said, "You have been raised from the dead." That's what he said. And that's an even odder statement, perhaps, than a seed doesn't look like a flower any more than a resurrected body looks like a person who died, which he wrote to the Corinthians. These ancient passages, written long before the Gospels, completely undo for me the common assumptions that resurrection means the resuscitation of a cold corpse or a growing again of a 30,000-year-old seed into a 21st-century flower that looks exactly like it did millennia ago. Paul used the growth of a tiny dark seed into brightly colored blossoms to speak of his idea that there was a resurrection of some sort after Jesus died, but not the kind that portrays Jesus as a fleshy being rising out of a tomb with a rollaway stone. Paul knows of no such story and uses only the image of a seed growing into a flower to speak of the language of life. The poet Juan Pablo Gutierrez, with whom I spent some time last summer, also tells us that there is a language that a flower might speak to convey grand and beautiful ideas. "Everywhere they grow and blossom," he says. "And in passing, we wave to you in your public spaces, in your empty lots, in your abandoned sites, in your wealthy gardens, in your churches, in your pagan rituals, in your atheist gardens, at the street corner, on sidewalks, on makeshift altars." That's a broad and quite diverse list of places where flowers might be found. Then Juan Pablo begins to speak in grammatical terms. He speaks of clear syllables to be found in the flowers and action verbs and sentences without punctuation marks. All of these are clear examples of language, of speech, of communication. He sees the gatherings of flowers as a colorful text on the page of life. "I turn the page again," he says, "finding a new awakening, maybe a rising, as I continue to learn the language of the flowers." Poet Linda Paston speaks of the language of flowers too, referring to the old Victorian notion that different kinds of flowers express different ideas and emotions and concepts. "With petals of roses for love," she writes, "snowdrops stand for hope." There was a whole code back in Victorian days. Depending on what flower you wore, you were communicating a certain message, including things like, "I really love that guy over there," or "I really love that woman over there." They were ashamed to talk about such emotions openly, so they put on flowers. Paston mentions weddings where flowers speak of love, even if there's only three people gathered for the ceremony. And she speaks of funerals too. Believe me, the absolutely gorgeous flowers sent by the Board of Trustees of this congregation to the funeral home where my mother was laid out back in November spoke to me. They spoke of care and love and understanding to me. I didn't need a translator. The language of the flowers is actually pretty obvious, I think, most of the time. Linda Paston even mentions the sailing of ocean liners, where people sometimes toss flowers of farewell into the foam of those traveling away. Juan Pablo goes a lot further than Linda Paston. In his little book, he composes poems for almost 50 specific kinds of flowers, assigning them meanings and speech. The magnolia, he says, signs faithful relationships. The calla lily, or Alcatraz in Spanish, I didn't know that that's what the word Alcatraz meant, speaks of sexuality. That's pretty obvious if you've ever seen a calla lily. The quince, some of which you can find toward the back of the church where the bike racks are, beautiful color in the flowers. The quince speaks of travel, because the seeds originated in China, traveled to Arabia, and finally to this garden, he says. Jasmine flowers speak of the goddess. The cherry blossoms are the yearly trumpeted proclamation of the spring. Clearly, flowers are rich invitations to considerations in life. My friend Kevin's spiritual practice is to every single morning paint a watercolor of some local flower. And I mean paint a watercolor, rain or shine, out in Oakland, California, where he lives. Or he brings his watercolors with him to Barcelona or to Prague if he happens to be traveling there on business, which he often does. By now, he's painted over 1,000 flowers. And all of them speak to me of nature's sheer extravagance. And in our own Unitarian Universalist tradition, we celebrate with flowers. Every Sunday, there's flowers up here, certainly. But today, especially on Easter, we celebrate the flower ceremony created by Norbert Čapek in Prague. Čapek felt that flowers spoke of, in his words, the inherent value of beautiful diversity in beautiful community. He said nothing could say it better than the flower ceremony. His congregation in Prague, a large congregation of several thousand people, couldn't have agreed more. They continue to celebrate this ceremony as well, as we do, 70 years after he, Čapek, was put to death at Dachau by the Nazis for refusing to deny what the flowers proclaimed. Beautiful diversity in beautiful community. Everyone is welcome. No one can be excluded. The language of the Selene stenophylla, restored by Russian scientists, may speak too, but I assure you, it tells us nothing about the meaning of Easter. It's speaking of the brilliance of the scientists. It speaks of an earlier age on this earth. But the flower really hasn't been resurrected in the way the media are trying to portray it. In fact, trying to bring back what lived long ago will not often work at all, even if we could pull off the more spectacular Jurassic Park types of resurrection that I mentioned to the children. The giant dragonfly from the Permian era, I think it was called Menagerun, should it be restored by some very, very clever scientist, would die again almost immediately once it had been brought back because of the oxygen content being so much less now than it was in the Permian. But if even Jesus, for example, was brought literally back from the grave, like some folks seem to say that he was, he wouldn't last long either. His teaching spoke to a world of agriculture, not Columbus, to a culture of Roman oppression, which no longer exists. And let's be honest, anyone walking around now suggesting that people should share with each other, should actually bother to listen to each other, and that the 99 versus the 1% that we hear about revealing very bad odds for some people wouldn't be around long anyway. He wouldn't need a Pontius Pilate or a Roman recruit to do the job either. He'd be ridiculed to death on a cross of sarcasm on Fox News in about 5 minutes once he opened his mouth. Or, considering what's been going on at the OSU campus these last few weeks, somebody might just paint a swastika on his forehead and shoot him with their lawful firearm for being a Jew. No, we who are part and parcel of our era and age can't just live in any time and place, any other culture. We can only be here. We cannot separate ourselves from our environment or our age or our location. Paul was right, I think. The seed that was Jesus or Moses or Gandhi or Susan B. Anthony or Lydia Marie Child or Martin Luther King, once planted, will grow into something that does not look like them at all. As a matter of fact, when it grows, it will probably look a lot like us. We who live now, we who are alive in this culture, we who, as Paul said, have risen already, have been raised already, and who have to respond not to issues that haven't been around since the last Caesar died, but to the issues of our own day, with fierce honesty, with a vibrant spirit, with studied resistance. You don't, as the gospel angel reportedly said, seek the living among the dead. You seek the living among the living. Lydia Marie Child, one of the greatest proponents of the wisdom of diversity and community in the 19th century and a Unitarian, thought that the flowers she saw growing around her were like the gospel angels proclaiming the mysterious message in their strange and hieroglyphic language, she wrote. And the great John Muir, one of the most articulate nature mystics the world has ever known, wondered why Moses wanted to see more glory, that is, see God face to face. Well, if he had seen the sky and flowers around here in California, Muir mused, he might have thought better of such a request. What's more glorious than flowers, he wonders. But Moses, according to that biblical story, had already seen the great glory that Chopic's flowers proclaim and that Lydia's flowers proclaim, Lydia Child's flowers proclaim, that Paul proclaimed, namely that a community of oppressed people rise up and bud in an act of resistance and freedom. The more glory that Moses wanted for was simply for them to accept their freedom and to stop whining about how difficult freedom and justice are. Moses lived all of his life waiting for those buds to bloom fully. He died and never saw it. Jesus died and never saw his vision of a more just world come to pass. But look about you. We're alive. We're not like that Siberian flower grown from a seed which survived in the cold from long ago. We're more like these flowers on the table before us, a community of diversity blossoming not yesterday but today, not in some other time and place, but here and now, risen and alive, not dead, and with a mission to accomplish, not just on Easter, but on every single day of our lives.